providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in these final two segments of this hour, Shad and I are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. He also writes a retail newsletter called In the Know Trader, and a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick chooses no more than 7 out of 11 spider ETFs. Rick, I want to start with the U.S. equity markets because, look, it's been a pretty slow summer. The summer doldrums was a very reasonable and accurate way to explain it. But for U.S. equity markets, they just kept grinding higher. There's a lot of different factors that we can talk about, but I just want to start with general price action for U.S. markets, the broad averages. Rick, how much higher can these go in your eyes?
Good question. If I had to, well, how much higher over time? A heck of a lot higher. Over the near term, I'm thinking that what I've been telling clients is that from 45.60 in the S&P up to 46.50, so kind of that 90 points, which these days is about 2%, I expect the S&P to have some difficulty in just easily pushing through the way it has so many other different levels. So as we kind of get close to it now, we're not far away. We're at 45.30-ish, so we're only a percent away or so from, you know, the bottom end of that range. I think it'll struggle a bit. If I look at longer-term charts, I certainly can target 4,900, and that's kind of a measured move coming off of the March 2020 low. And back in 2013, when I was at Wells Fargo as head of cross-asset trading strategy, I remember publishing a report that said that the S&P will be at 5,000 in 10 years from now. Actually, it was now that I think it was 2014. It was June of 2014 because I knew it was 2024. And people laughed at me because the S&P was at 2,000 at that point. And here I am putting out a 5,000 target 10 years later. We're certainly getting very darn close. And I don't think we have to stop in around 5,000, but that is kind of a place that a long time ago I was able to decipher and expect that we'd have a massive bull market that could get us there over a 10-year period from what was then 2000. So when I look at where we're trading now, I look at where I have some shorter-term targets, I look at 5,000 as kind of a longer-term target, you know, it kind of gives me a sense that there's still a chance of as much as maybe 10% higher before we get a pullback that, you know, is a more meaningful one. And I'm not talking about a 5% pullback, but something that is, let's say it could be 10% or more. Am I looking for a bear market, which many people will qualify as a 20% pullback from a high? Not likely.
What about the whole crash scenario that we're hearing from a lot of commentators too, saying a big correction, not just a bear market, but a crash is coming?
Yeah. Well, how many of those people said that, 500 S&P points ago and 1,000 S&P points ago?
Plenty. I hear you, Rick. For the last decade, right? I've been saying that.
Right. And certainly since we saw the big sell-off in 2020 in the early part of the year, you've had people fighting this all the way up. For a long time, I've kind of thought about this 5,000 neighborhood as being the place that this was targeted for. And look, we haven't seen a 5% down move since last November. 5%, even if we got it, in the balance of, balance of today is only half a trading day, that would kind of be crash-like. But, even if it came sometime in the month of September, it's not a huge thing considering where we've come from back in 2020. We were under 2250, right? So the S&P has doubled in a year and a half. And we haven't had this 5% pullback since last November. So, a move like that can happen anytime. news that bearish news that's longer lasting than the typical 24 to 48 hours, which bearish news hits the market these days and just creates another buying opportunity for most people. You know, look, sooner or later, we're going to have something like that. It's going to come. But you can't really play for it. And when it does come, well, let me frame it this way. When we get a correction, it's still going to be a buying opportunity. So I'm not going to buy a 2% pullback. But, you know, if we get to levels that I can determine are places that I would expect buyers to re-show up, and I think that's going to be an ongoing process for a while, then I'm still basically in bullish mode. And then the question becomes just where you pick your places to add exposure over time and where you might trim some over time, just simply because of either we start finally getting into a trading range that lasts, you know, 6 months, or something that you can get some sense of back and forth, which you don't really get these days. It's a straight up move. We seven times we've already tested the 50-day moving average since last November. And something as simple as that has been the answer to you know, when to get your best bargain opportunities in S&P terms. But Corey, you also, and Shad, you have to think about the fact that despite the S&P and the broad cap indexes making new all-time highs, there's a lot of stocks that are not participating anything like that. You know, Russell 2000 breadth is a very different picture than S&P 500 breadth. So you've been in a sideways to lower range in that for a while. Mid-cap breadth has been pure sideways. Only the S&P 500 has continued kind of in the bull market. So it's a big cap rally, and the big cap names are what pushes, you know, the benchmarks, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ indices in their calculations. So you've had plenty of stocks that people have gotten hurt on, despite the fact that virtually every day we're making new all-time highs.
Yeah, Rick, I was going to ask you about that, because people are piled into really the same dozen or so high-flying names, and that's driving the index up, especially in the S&P and sometimes in the NASDAQ. But like you mentioned, the Russell 2000 and really the market breadth in general, there's a lot of sectors, or there's a lot of smaller niche sectors that are not participating. I like your approach and how you pick 7 out of the 11, you know, main ETFs that are either moving or not moving. What ones do you have your eye on that are undervalued that could possibly move higher at this point then?
Well, so in that 7-Eleven report, the goal of that report is to beat the return of the S&P 500 by being in no less than 5 or more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs that are the macro ETFs like XLB, XLE, XLK, etc. We just last week, I upgraded energy, which has been, you know, had an abysmal several months. After being the best performer and sharply outperforming the S&P this year, kind of dove, and I was just waiting for my signals to show up to come back in, and they showed up last week. So I've upgraded energy now, and think that that's a sector that the names have pulled back enough on that you're going to get outperformance from them. So it's one of the sectors too. If you think of, if you have some extra cash, should you buy spiders? I actually would rather buy XLE at this point, because I think it'll do better. So that's probably my favorite name or sector to go into now that you know, has been beaten up over the last several months, thinking that that bottom is probably being made right now, and that, you know, you can get some outperformance again from energy.
So Rick, big picture then, as we move out of summer, where are some of the key catalysts in your eyes for these markets to either continue to drive them higher or produce a short, maybe shallow correction? We hear a lot about Fed policy. We hear a lot about economic data that really gets taken on the flip side of it. If you get bad economic data, then everyone says, oh, the Fed's going to stick around, so that's going to be good for the markets. Or is it even outside the U.S. that we should be looking? Where do you think key catalysts are going to come from?
I think now what we've got to still kind of think about is that with the summer ending, that is going to likely increase as you get into colder temperatures. And kids going back to school, you know, let's call it, you know, COVID, whether it's the Delta variant, but you're probably going to see a jump in cases as we go into the fall. And, you know, clearly the market wasn't happy with it last year, and certainly the early part of the year before everything started rebounding. And look, COVID, nobody wants to see anybody get COVID. Nobody wants somebody in their family to have COVID. But in general, even the virus is initially, it's not going to make a material effect on corporate profits until it spreads enough that it materially changes the consumer's purchasing power and or corporations from because of supply chain issues and things that have been in effect because of COVID from 2020. Until you see that hit up again. I mean, my wife and I ordered a new couch for our living room in, I think it was the first week of February. And it just came 3 weeks ago. It was supposed to come in May, and then it got delayed, and then it got delayed. So we ended up getting it in like mid-August. And the explanation was supply chain issues. And it's stuff like that that, you know, could ultimately slow the economy down, depending upon how bad Delta variant gets in the fall. And you could see trickle through effect, in which case maybe people say, you know what, we can always buy stocks again, but let's take some profits. And so that's certainly to me a key thing. You know, looking outside this country, part of it can be, again, how bad, let's say, European cases get and Asian cases get, because if factories close down, that's going to affect, again, supply chain and potentially then corporate profits. If Europe, let's say, closes their countries down from visitors coming, you're going to affect tourism. Look today, even the worst performers, you know, are the cruise lines today. So I don't think it's going to be a huge effect. You're not going to see a decline like you saw in the first quarter of 2020, but could, given the upward trajectory of this market without any, you know, real correction of significance, could it happen? Absolutely. And when it does, you know, I'll be prepared for it. I have some cash on the sidelines waiting. And I've even told, you know, clients, how, and I'm not going to mention it, how we're doing this specifically, but that if you want to hedge your books and your equity exposure, one of the ways that I think to do that is to buy put spreads on whether you want to do it on the S&P or NASDAQ or wherever you have, you know, the exposure that you want to hedge. You buy a put spread, so you'll buy the put of the higher price of the two strikes and sell the lower strike against it, which reduces the cost of the hedge, but it also doesn't protect you against a crash and essentially gets you long as you get closer to that lower put price. And that's okay by me, because I don't think this whole thing is going to fall apart to the point that, you know, you devastate this market and you go into an extended bear market. So if something happens, you know, I'm still, like right now, if I'm looking for a put spread, I might do something in the S&P. Again, we're roughly trading at 45.30. You know, I might buy 42.5 puts and sell, I don't know, 4,000s or 39.50s against it, something like that. I don't think, you know, we go down much more than that. I don't see us getting whacked all the way down to, you know, 3,300 or something, which was the all-time high going into the 2020 huge decline. You know, so I don't see us falling 1,200 S&P points or anything like that. So I still think in general, this is a bull market that at some point gets its correction, and you live through the correction. Hopefully you're hedged some of your book for it, and then you put exposure back on.
Well, Rick, one question that comes to mind is, you know, while we may not see the crash and we may not see something that's very prolonged, there's a lot of pundits and a lot of articles we see out in the financial mainstream media talking about a potential slowdown in the reopening trade. You mentioned cruise lines, really the whole hospitality sector, airlines, hotels, rental cars. We'll take it on the chin if there is less traveling this winter and if we don't open up the borders to travel to other countries. But there's also, you know, the potential that we may enter that stagflationary kind of environment like we saw in the 70s, where we still have some rising inflation to some degree. Some of that may be supply chain related, but some of it may be stickier inflation. But we may see a slowdown in growth. How do you see that may affect? Could we just grind sideways in these markets for a long period of time and just frustrate people? Or what's your outlook there if we got into more of that stagflationary environment?
Well, my guess is that the next, let's say 5 years, the growth in the in market terms, so let's say price appreciation, probably won't match anything like we've seen in the last year and a half. As far as, you know, if you annualize the last year and a half and you look at the move from 2250 in the S&P to 4500, a doubling, so a year and a half, so that makes it, you know, two-thirds of that. That's probably going to be a heck of a lot better than you'll see going forward in the next 5 years on average. So we definitely could get slowed growth. You could get slower or lesser returns in the market. And as you get the rotations like you do, you could be in a larger sideways type environment. But I think the people who are calling for a crash, and I've been around, this is now 40 years on Wall Street. So I've lived through crashes, crash in 87, you know, the 96 crash with the long-term capital blowing up and the Russian debt crisis, and then, you know, 07, 08 into the 09 bottom. I've seen them before. I've lived through them. I've traded them. I'm very familiar with them and the flash crash in 2010. But I think that you've got to still keep your exposure in stocks. Again, you can reduce some, but to play for a crash, to me, is more, let's call it a combination of ego and calling for something that if it doesn't happen, most people are going to forget about. But if it happens, you get to be, you know, on the cover of Wall Street Journal saying you called the crash. The thing is, over the years, you know, if we go back to the 1987 crash, two well-known Wall Streeters predicted that crash, got very famous for them for making that call. And then that was kind of the last time that they were famous for making a call, you know, and it's over 30 years later. Calling for a crash is so you can say, I told you so. Look at a 100-year chart of the S&P or the Dow or, you know, any major index, and it's going to start in the lower left-hand corner of your screen and end on the upper right. And to play for the occasional times that you get these, you know, events that change things quickly is kind of a fool's game. There's no better place to be invested than in the stock market over time. And let's keep crypto out of it for the time being, because that's just, you know, you can't count on steady returns without taking 50% drawdowns all the time. So, you know, when you think about what is truly accepted as an investment, you have real estate, you have equities, you have bonds, you have, you know, commodities, hard assets. Almost everybody realizes that equities are the place to be when you have when you're minding a long-term portfolio. So even if we get a pullback, and even if it was 1,000 S&P points, which would be, you know, over 20%, and you'd be in quote a bear market, we're not going back down to anything near 2020 lows. I'm not sure we're even going to be near early 2020 highs again in this market. So I think you think about a bond market that probably is going to lead towards higher yields over time. That's the way I'm playing it. That's the way I'm positioned. I have very few bonds left in my portfolio. I've hedged almost my entire book. Where's all that money going to go that was in the bond market if people start selling out of bonds and interest rates go higher? A heck of a lot of it is going to go into the stock market.
Fair enough, Rick. So overall, though, still sounds like very much a buy-the-dip mentality in the U.S. equity markets. Let's shift focus a little bit to commodities then. What's your outlook for something like the precious metals? After now just over a year-long correction, gold went down on a flash crash just a few weeks ago, tested that 1675 level, right back to around 1800. We're ending the week here with gold moving higher on the back of that weaker than expected jobs report, but still right around that 1830 level. Still a lot of work to do on the upside. What is your outlook for gold?
I was very concerned on that, what you're calling, you know, the crash down from, you know, what was almost, 1800 down to 1675 in a matter of 2 weeks. But being that we stopped where we did at 1675, which is now a triple bottom on a long-term gold chart, I was tempted to sell out of my gold holdings, but I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't. You know, one of the things that investors often lose sight of is the time that price spends at a certain level, not just the price itself. And the reality is that if you look at a gold chart, let's say you look at a weekly bar chart of gold, and you go back 3-4 weeks to that week that sold down, you know, we closed near the upper end of the range that week. So you had a spike down, and you know, it was not fun watching gold go from 1750 to 1675 in 2 days. But then it rebounded, and so it spent very little time. It was another spike low into a pure horizontal support line at 1675. So the fact that it was a spike and we spent no time down there meant that weak-handed longs got knocked out. And the people buying what the weak-handed longs were selling out were probably more investors. People said, I'll take advantage of other people's pain and buy what they're puking out. And the fact that gold has been up now every week since then makes me think gold is okay. I mean, we're getting closer to the downtrend line from all-time highs. And if you can pop through there and then take out the 2021 highs, or let's say the mid-year highs, from the spring, somewhere near, 1925, I think it was, then gold should be able to test its all-time highs and possibly even, you know, go higher. So I'm still sticking with gold. I certainly have a line in the sand now beneath 1675, and I wouldn't really want to have to give back that much. But the market clearly showed that that level was a pure kind of flash crash type event, and there's been straight buying since then. So I like gold.
Yeah, Rick, we definitely want to see that 1675 triple bottom hold, and it has been a little bit more peppy lately. One question I have, just following up on your previous comment about some of the rotation out of bonds, you mentioned that you think a lot of it will go into the general markets, but we've also been in that negative real rate environment where we've seen inflation creeping up. And what I was alluding to earlier with the 1970s comment on the stagflation was that we may see inflation stay sticky, and if rates, even if they go up some, if real rates are still negative, that's traditionally a good environment for gold. Couldn't some of that money leave the bond market and in pension funds or large institutions, couldn't some of it land in gold as a way to at least have their money not depreciate so much as it would be sitting in bonds that are getting eroded by inflation? Do you think it's possible there'd be a rotation from bonds into gold as well as the general markets?
I think it's possible you'll see some trickle into gold. But if those funds aren't invested in gold yet, then I'm not sure, you know, some of it is because the mandate of the fund doesn't allow them to go into an asset like gold. But let's say they have a mandate that allows them to, yes, you could see some trickle into gold. You might see more go towards cryptos simply because the human mind and behavioral analysis suggests that people like to be in what other people are making money in. And being that, you know, Bitcoin's back to 50,000, Ethereum's making new highs, actually even outperforming Bitcoin these days, or actually Ethereum's near its high. It's the type of thing that you may see that cryptos become more of an accepted asset class simply because you don't want to be, you know, fear of missing out, the FOMO type thing. And if corporate boards allow, imagine if they even let up to 2% of a bond fund have assets in crypto, what the inflows can be over time. I still have a hard time getting a handle around cryptos as a truly acceptable investment, even though I've got money myself in Ethereum and I've made 50% this year. You know, so I can't complain. But if any of that becomes more accepted, then the exit out of the bond market, certainly you'll see money go into equities. You might get some into, you know, the gold market, but you may very well see this, again, a certain percent. I can't see any major pension plan saying, you know, you can go up to 10% in crypto. I think that would be hugely speculative and not in the best interest of the people who are relying on that pension plan down the road. But even a small percentage in, you know, some of these companies have billions of dollars in their pension plans. So even, you know, 1 or 2% allowing into some type of asset like that can make a huge difference. So I think, to answer your question, Chad, that yeah, some will trickle into gold, but I think there's also this, the crypto people have done a heck of a good job at marketing something. Whether or not it's it's valid, that's a whole different story. But it's becoming, rightly or wrongly, more accepted. And that's a place that even I would tell my kids, who, you know, I've gotten them to invest in their 20s and put away money. I have a son who's 20. How old is he? 23. And he already has a Roth IRA. And just, you know, sent me an email the other day that he wants to add another $750 into it. And where should he put it? You know, I might tell him, put a third of it into crypto. And then the rest into stocks. And he's got a 40-year hold on this before he's going to touch the money. But I just think that bonds are not the place as an investment. They're not going to do you any good over time. And if rates go up, you're going to lose more money. You'll have capital depreciation in your bonds. You'll lose more than in the interest rate that you're getting. I just think I personally just can't get into the idea of owning bonds with such low returns.
Okay, Rick, a follow-up question then. Real quick, for cryptos, it's been interesting to see Ethereum outperforming Bitcoin. Now, both are moving higher, so to your point, right, outperforming assets do draw more attention than those that are underperforming. But this move into Ethereum, is that telling you something more about this market too, that it's maybe a different type of investor too that's entering this market and taking a different look at cryptos broadly?
You know, it might be. My stepson was, I had three of them, and two of them were particularly into cryptos. And we were talking when I was kind of a total naysayer. And I was a naysayer even, I think, just before I decided to put some money in, fully recognizing I could lose all of it. But so I was willing to put in an amount that I was comfortable that if it disappeared from my life altogether and crypto went to zero, it wasn't going to change my life. He convinced me to get into Ethereum rather than Bitcoin because of its actual practical usage, and that it made sense to him, who had done the research, that it made more sense to be in Ethereum than Bitcoin. So I bought some Ethereum myself. I don't know much about Cardano or any of these other ones. You know, pretty much both Bitcoin and Ethereum have futures contracts that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has listed. And if they've listed it, you can have some pretty good assurance that these are the cream of the crop of cryptos. So there are Bitcoin futures, there are Ethereum futures. Now you can trade them. You know, there's plenty of other ways to trade them besides having a futures account. But the fact that those two have listed futures say to me that these are far more legitimate than Dogecoin and, you know, all these. There's God knows how many of crypto coins that you're playing a complete guessing game. At least these I know have institutional participation by the fact that they're listed as futures contracts. I just personally feel more comfortable because of that. It gives me more confidence in Ethereum than any other one besides, let's say, Bitcoin. But I chose Ethereum because of, you know, the supposed use of the actual coin as compared to, or the Ether, the process that Ether creates as compared to any other coin other than Bitcoin. So,
okay. Well, Rick, we'll wrap it up there. That's some interesting comments on cryptos and also the potential money flows that we could see if the markets, or well, really, if treasuries start to sell off too, and where that money might rotate. Look, I think we're all looking forward to getting out of summer and having a bit more active trading, and who knows, maybe some new trends being established as well. Rick, it's great having you on the show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in this weekend. We're going to be back on it a little after the long weekend, back on Tuesday. And again, that's after Labor Day, so we're all expecting a bit more traders back at their desk. Rick, thanks again for your time this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
Thank you, guys. The pleasure is always.